From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
The chain was around my stomach and there was a big lock on it. So any time that I wanted to turn to my side, I would have to move the chain to put the lock in the front of my stomach.
Today, Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, two of the three women who were abducted as teenagers and held for 10 years by Ariel Castro in his Cleveland home. They were chained and repeatedly raped. Amanda has a daughter he fathered.
She saw the chains, and we had to tell her like they were bracelets, and she would ask him, well, why do you lock the door?
We'll also talk with journalist Mary Jordan, who co-authored their memoir about their ordeal and escape. Also, Lloyd Schwartz shares his admiration for the string quartet Brooklyn Rider, and John Powers discusses Norwegian writer Carl Ove Knausgård's celebrated series of autobiographical novels called My Struggle. Book 4 was just published in English. That's on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After 10 years of a search for the missing girls Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, family, friends, the police, and Americans who had followed the story were shocked and relieved when they escaped in 2013. Now they are telling their story in a new book called Hope, a memoir of survival in Cleveland. Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus are my guests, along with Mary Jordan, one of the two journalists who co-wrote their memoir. A third woman was held captive with Berry and DeJesus and escaped with them, Michelle Knight. She's written her own memoir. Amanda Berry was abducted by Ariel Castro on the day before her 17th birthday in 2003. Gina DeJesus was taken by him nearly a year later when she was 14 and in 7th grade. Castro chained the girls, raped them, often several times a day, and nearly starved them. He was captured shortly after they escaped and killed himself after about 1 month in prison. It was only after they escaped that anyone knew that Berry had given birth to a daughter, Jocelyn, fathered by Castro during Berry's captivity. Jocelyn is now 8 years old. Amanda Berry, Gina DeJesus, Mary Jordan, welcome to Fresh Air. Amanda and Gina, I'm wondering if it was helpful or awful to go through the process of writing the book and reliving those memories so that you could work on the book. Amanda, you want to start?
I knew it was going to be a little tough, but I think it got tougher at some points than others that, you know, I just kind of wasn't expecting.
What was one of those points for you where it was hard?
Talking about the harder things in the house, like the things that he would do or...
Do to you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Gina, what about you? Is this like a therapeutic process or a difficult one?
I was kind of excited to do it, and then, like, a little bit into it, it was just, I guess, too much for me.
Mary, why did you want to write this story?
I'm a correspondent and I've lived around the world and seen really sad, painful tragedies. And, you know, you always wonder how people can get through pain. And here I talked to Amanda and Gina and made lifelong friends and helped them try to explain to everyone else how you do it. And what you do is you find a mental life raft somehow. And they'll tell you, you know, for Amanda and Gina, their life raft was they clung to hope that they would get out of there, they would outlast their captor, and they would get back to their families.
We're always told don't get into a car with a stranger. And you each voluntarily got in Ariel Castro's car, but you kind of knew him and you knew his children. And in that sense, he wasn't really a stranger. I mean, you had no reason to expect that the father of children who you knew could be as horrible and violent and cruel. What made you realize that getting in the car with him was a mistake? What was the first inkling you had that he was a terrible man?
I was kind of freaking out a little bit when he didn't turn around. But then when he started talking to me about his daughter and how he was going to take his daughter to the mall and stuff, I kind of a little bit relaxed, but not really because I was still a little scared.
And Amanda?
He didn't seem... He wasn't mean in the car. Like, he was talkative, and he kept the conversation going, and he was talking about his kids, and how one of his kids worked at the Burger King that I worked at because I had my uniform on. So that, you know, he was talking about that for a couple of minutes. I mean, I couldn't tell that he was this horrible man talking to him in the van.
So during so much of your captivity, you were kept chained to a pole or to a radiator. How long was the chain? Like how many feet about were you able to walk before the chain ran out?
Like 5 feet, I think. I was like, I couldn't really do nothing. I mean, you had enough room to get up and use the bathroom or something like that, but...
When you say bathroom, you mean the pot in the room. You weren't allowed to really use the bathroom most of the time, right?
Oh, yeah, no. There was a garbage can in there that I had to use for the bathroom.
What happened to you physically being chained that much? I mean, you must have gone crazy physically as well as emotionally and mentally.
Yes, it was tough, and you know, trying to sleep, and the chain was around my stomach, so, and there was a big lock on it. So anytime that I wanted to turn to my side, I would have to move the chain to put the lock in the front of my stomach, or, you know, I'd be laying on this big chain and this big lock, and it was just uncomfortable.
Among the horrible things that happened to you when you were held hostage is that you were raped repeatedly by Ariel Castro, sometimes 3-4 times a day. He knew he had a sex problem. Amanda, he told you he had a sex problem. What did he tell you about himself?
He said it like came from when he was younger, and, you know, he said that he was molested as a little boy, and, you know, from there, things just, I guess he got, I don't know, maybe it messed him up in the head or something, because he got worse after that. Like, he started noticing, you know, more.
Mary, as the journalist working on the story, what were you able to learn about Ariel Castro's sexual problem, his sexual addiction, whatever you want to call it, that led to enslaving 3 women?
He had a real problem with women, to say the least. He had a common law wife that he...
I'm just going to stop for a second, because I said women. I should really be saying girls. I mean, Gina, you were in seventh grade. Amanda, you were abducted the day before your 17th birthday. So anyways, let me let you continue, Mary.
Okay. Before he started kidnapping girls, he had a common law wife, and he beat her. I mean, it was terribly. Stomped on her head, broke her teeth. He said to Amanda and Gina in the house that he hated his mother. He also, by the way, went to her house. He's very hard to figure out, but I think the root of a lot of this was, you know, the violence against Amanda and Gina, and what he did to his common law wife was terrible, terrible.
The common law wife pressed charges against him. But she eventually dropped the charges?
Because he was so intimidated. He'd waited outside the court. She finally, his common law wife, finally got the courage to go and try to press domestic violence charges against him. And he waited outside the courthouse and said he'd kill her. She went in there and kept pursuing charges against him. And by the way, if you don't do that, I'll give you a car. Of course, he never gave her anything, just threats. It's the real tragedy here that this domestic violence went unchecked, and it went on for years and years before he started kidnapping girls.
And there were other things that seemed like they could have been clues about how something was terribly wrong with him. I mean, so you have 3 girls who have gone missing, and in a nearby neighborhood, you have this man who has been charged with domestic abuse, even though the charges were dropped. I think it was probably clear they were withdrawn under pressure. He has, you know, the windows covered with quilts and other things. He has all this, like, junk collecting in his backyard in a way that looks kind of weird from how it's described in the book. And no one thinks of checking him out as a possibility to see whether there might be girls hidden in there? Does that surprise you, Mary?
You know, he was very clever. We can't underestimate how smooth he was. He was a school bus driver.
Well, that's another amazing part of the story.
He was a musician. He kept himself tidy. He kind of was unremarkable. He was the kind of guy that you pass on the street. He would say hello. You'd never think about him. He was unremarkable. He almost was like the wallpaper. You know, at the end, he said to himself, I can't believe I was able to keep this a secret for 10 years. But really, it was a credit to himself. And if you walked down the street, you didn't see that he had put a door and nailed it to those windows and had quilts because he pulled the curtains. He had the curtains inside. And he tidied up his front lawn. You know, his house was a mess because he was a big hoarder. But he was very clever. He was saying hello to neighbors. He was sweet. He drove the school bus. He was good to his friends. He just had a double life. And when he walked inside his front door, he became a whole other violent person.
Amanda, Gina, each of you had a TV. Like, that's the thing that he enabled you to do while you were chained up. There was a TV in front of you. And you write about how you'd watch the news reports about you having gone missing. And it sounds just so, like, what a weird experience. You're watching the news. You're seeing reports of how you're missing. You're seeing reports that you're maybe dead. Among the things that you saw, Amanda, was a psychic going on television on the Montel Williams show and telling your mother that you're dead. You saw that somebody else who had confessed to killing you and who said that your grave, that he dug you a grave, you saw people go and digging that grave live, broadcast on television. I can't imagine what that experience was like for you to be seeing all of this. Can you give us a sense of what was going through your mind as you saw, for instance, men digging for what was supposed to be your body, or watching a psychic tell your mother that you're dead?
Well, when I seen it was like breaking news that somebody had said that they're digging for my body, and I'm like, I mean, I was happy because I was in the news and, you know, I was probably going to see my sister or someone in my family. But I was like, it made me really sad because I'm thinking, like, what is my family going through? Like, what are they thinking right now? Like, you know, they're probably just so upset and crying. And so, I mean, I just felt like really, like, just so bad.
And then, Amanda, you watched the news that your mother had died. She had had, was it pancreatic cancer?
No.
Just another pancreatic illness?
Yes.
Followed by a massive heart attack?
Yes.
A terrible, you know, I'm so sorry that you never got to see her again and that she died without knowing that you were alive. Did you expect your kidnapper to show any kind of emotion or remorse at that point?
I mean, I didn't know. I didn't know, like, what he was going to do. I mean, he told me if anyone ever passed, like, you know, someone really important to me, that he would let me go. But, you know, that time came and he didn't.
Let you go free or let you go to their funeral? I guess it would be the same thing. You couldn't go to their funeral without being freed. People would see you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did he lie to you a lot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just... That was everything. He lied about pretty much everything.
Amanda, I think when you were finally free and you emerged with your daughter, who was born while you were enslaved in this house in Cleveland, the world was shocked to know that you'd had a baby. And if you don't mind my asking, when you found out that you were pregnant from being raped, how did you decide you wanted to keep the baby?
I mean, I didn't know what was going to happen or what he was going to say or... But I mean, I wanted to keep the baby. I just wasn't sure what he was going to do.
So you raised a baby while you were being held captive. And in that sense, the baby was captive too. But I think one of the things that really surprised you is that your captor, Ariel Castro, fell in love with the child. And seemed really happy to be a father and thought of you and him and the baby as being this, like, this family, which I'm sure isn't exactly the way you saw it.
Oh, no, not at all.
What was the point where you thought your daughter might start to become aware of the fact that things weren't right with how you were living?
She saw the chains, and we had to tell her, like, they were bracelets, and she would notice that he would lock the door when he left, and she would ask him, well, why do you lock the door, and why can't you leave the door unlocked, or why can't you leave the door open, and he would just come up with a story to tell her, and that would be that.
So Castro gave your daughter more freedom than he gave his captives.
Yes.
My guests are Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, who were abducted by Ariel Castro and held in captivity for about a decade until they escaped. Also with us is journalist Mary Jordan, who co-wrote their new memoir, Hope. Amanda, you were able to escape because one day Ariel Castro left your bedroom door unlocked. He had been telling you, like, don't worry, this is going to end soon. Do you think he intentionally left it unlocked?
No, I don't think he would have. He wasn't going to do anything until he was ready. Like, if he was ever even going to let us go home, like, he wouldn't have just left the door open expecting, like, oh, somebody's going to try to get out. Like, he wouldn't have done that.
Tell us how you realized the door was unlocked, the bedroom door.
Well, it was open because it was a warm day. So when he's home, when he was there, he would, like, leave the doors open so we can get fresh air because, like, our windows are, like, were boarded up and there was no fresh air coming in. It would get so hot and so stuffy. And there's, like, a gate that goes there so we know, like, you don't go in the hallway, you don't go downstairs, stay in your room. And my daughter had went downstairs to look for him. She couldn't find him, and she came back upstairs and she told me that, like, he wasn't there. I'm like, no, well, he's here somewhere because the door is open, so he has to be here. You know, just go look again. So she looked again, and she came back upstairs, and she's like, no, I think he's gone, and his car is gone, his blue car is gone. And for a minute, I'm like, no, he's got to be here somewhere. But I felt like, oh, well, what if he isn't here? Like, what if this is my chance to do something?
So you went downstairs and opened the door, and then you discovered something you didn't know that was there, which was a storm door that was padlocked shut.
Yes. That was, I think the worst thing, because I was so scared of, like, opening. I was like, well, once I open the big front door, like, I'll just open the screen door, and, like, that's the easy part. You run out and you're free. But no, there was, like, it was a roadblock, another roadblock to my freedom. And I was so scared because I don't know, he could have showed up at any time, and who knows what would have happened to me. It was so scary.
So you started screaming for help because you couldn't get through the padlocked storm door, and one or two neighbors came over? Do I have that right?
Yes.
And what did they do to help you?
Well, the neighbor next door, like, he saw me, like, waving my hand out, and I'm, you know, kind of going crazy on the door, and the neighbor comes next door, and he comes up on the porch, and I don't know if he didn't want to, like, break down the door because I don't know if he knew what was going on or what, but then I'm, like, telling him who I am, and please let me out. Like, help me. I can't get out. And he's trying to open the door, but then he realized that there's a lock on there. So he kind of was, like, just looking at the door to figure out something, so he kind of kicks the bottom because the bottom was, like, a little flimsy, and I hadn't realized that. So once he, like, kicked it a little bit, he's like, well, go ahead, finish kicking it out. And so I kicked it out a little bit more, just enough so I could fit through there. And then I climbed out, and then I had my daughter climb out, and we were free.
And then you borrowed a phone, and I guess it was your neighbor who helped you get out, called 911. Is that what happened?
Yes. The neighbor called 911, and I called 911.
My guests are Amanda Berry, Gina DeJesus, who were abducted and held captive by Ariel Castro, and journalist Mary Jordan, who co-wrote their new memoir, Hope. After we take a short break, we'll hear more about that 911 call. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is supported by Squarespace, providing online tools for individuals and businesses to create a website. With hosting, 24/7 support, domains, e-commerce, and more, Squarespace enables people to share their story online in a way that reflects who they are and what they're all about. Visit squarespace.com/freshair for more information and a free trial.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, who were both abducted and held captive by Ariel Castro. Berry was taken in 2003 on the day before her 17th birthday. DeJesus was taken about a year later when she was 14 and in seventh grade. They were chained and repeatedly raped. They escaped in 2013. Berry emerged with a daughter, Jocelyn, who was conceived and born during Berry's captivity. Also with us is Mary Jordan, one of the two journalists who co-wrote their new memoir, Hope, about their decade-long ordeal. When we left off, Amanda Berry was describing how she escaped Castro's home and managed to call 911 on a neighbor's phone. So, Mary, you were able to listen to, I guess, a recording of the 911 phone call between the dispatcher and Amanda when Amanda made her call for help. And part of that call is reprinted in the book. Mary, would you, as a reporter, would you give us your impression, like describe that phone call and give us your impression of it?
Well, you could hear how desperate and frantic it was. And, you know, if you lived in Cleveland, the words Amanda Berry, everyone knew them. I mean, her face was on telephone poles and bulletin boards. And to hear, help me, I'm Amanda Berry, it was like a ghost had come back. But that desperation in the voice was chilling. It really went through the city, right through the spine of the city. Help me, I'm Amanda Berry.
Did the 911 dispatcher know who Amanda Berry was?
Amazingly, the one person in this whole city that didn't seem to be that dispatcher, and very dispassionate. In fact, he was so kind of lackadaisical and okay. You know, not keeping you even on the phone the whole time until the police were there. He actually got disciplined for how he handled it. So it was kind of ironic that the one person who didn't know Amanda Berry was a young dispatcher. Obviously wasn't there 10 years ago when she was taken.
And she kept asking him not to hang up, right?
Right, right. It was incredible. I mean, it was so embarrassing to the police department.
What do you know? I know he confessed. What can you tell us about his confession?
He confessed to everything. He said he was sorry. He said he loved his daughters, the one who was born inside, as well as the daughters and the children he had from his common-law wife. But it was very rambling and clearly of a man, very confused, conflicted man.
Mary, the book reprints a letter that was part suicide note that Ariel Castro wrote in 2004, the year of the kidnappings. And he writes, "The bottom line is, I am a sexual predator who needs help, but I don't bother to get it. I live a private life. I function around others like a normal person.
I've been having problems with my head for a long time. I feel depressed, dizzy, and short-term memory loss. I really don't know what's wrong with me. To the parents of these three women, I would like to say, I'm very sorry, I am sick. This is a big problem in my everyday life. I just want to put an end to my life and let the devil deal with me. Now, he wrote that at the beginning of the story of taking them captive.
He wrote that right after he had taken Gina. So he had three women in his, you know, three girls in his house. He seemed to be compulsive and take them, and then he had them. And he didn't want to kill them, but he also didn't want to go to jail. And so I think over time, this double life was harder and harder to maintain, and he had headaches. I mean, the whole miracle in this story is that the longer someone is kidnapped, the less likely that they are alive, they're found alive. And that's why I think, again, the police were literally falling to their knees, just shocked that after all these years, they were alive.
It's kind of remarkable, I think, that someone as deeply disturbed as he was and who knew he had a problem functioned in the real world to the extent that he did, driving a school bus. He was suspended for 60 days without pay driving the school bus because a parent filed a complaint against something he did to her son. There was a domestic abuse charge against him. He had repeatedly beaten his son and his common-law wife. There was a charge against him, you know, as a school bus driver, and still just everything kind of continued in his life.
Well, you think about all the what-ifs, and it makes you crazy because, you know, if domestic violence, if that was noted so that a government, you know, or a school office couldn't hire somebody with those kind of charges, maybe he would have, if he had gotten punished then, he would have stopped. If he had gotten punished when he left a little boy on the school bus and drove away, kept him on the bus, yelled at him, called him names, went in and left the poor little kid there when he had lunch, if he had been fired, I mean, there's so many what-ifs. A policeman stopped him on his motorcycle when he had three girls inside, and he didn't have his driver's license, the correct driver's license, and his license was wrong. If it was a pretty big offense, and he just said, okay, well, just don't drive and just walk your bike home. You know, so many times if he had gotten called on it, but he was always so polite, always kind of well-dressed, well-kept. He didn't really look like a monster. He looked kind of like a middle-aged guy. He mowed his lawn. He said hi. He was kind of the perfectly boring guy that you never suspected.
When you were both released, you know, like Amanda, you say in the book that you didn't want to become that person who was afraid of everybody, and you didn't want to become the person who was afraid of every man. And you wrote that while you were being held captive and chained to the radiator. But when you were released, was it comfortable being back in the world? I mean, you desperately wanted to be there, but it must have been a terrifying place in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it was scary at first. I mean, it still is a little bit. I mean, I kind of had to get used to everything again, and, you know, I was scared for a while to even walk outside by myself. Like,
I don't blame you. Gina, what were some of the things that you found kind of scary when you re-entered the world?
Trusting people and walking to the corner store and always looking back to see if someone's right behind you, ready to take you or something.
Did you have bad dreams, and do you still?
I have bad dreams sometimes.
Do you dream that you're still locked up?
Or he's going to take me again.
Right. So is it reassuring to know that he can't do that because he committed suicide after a month in prison?
Yeah, sometimes I tell my mom about my dreams, and then I laugh it off. I was like, ha, he can't do that because he's dead.
And Amanda, for you, it's very complicated. I'm sure part of you is really relieved that he can no longer hurt you again, but he's also the father of your daughter.
Yeah. I mean, I'm conflicted still, but I mean, I will always hate him for everything that he did to my family and to us.
But what did you want your daughter to be able to do or to know about him that won't be possible now because he's dead?
I just want her to know that he loved her and he still loves her.
You wanted her to know that?
Mm-hmm.
And you had hoped that she would have a chance to talk to him and ask him.
Oh, yeah, one day, maybe two. I hope that, you know, if she ever wanted to one day go and ask him, like, why did you do this? You know, and, like, give her answers or, I don't know, any questions that she had about any of this.
Amanda, one of the things you did, you tried to homeschool your daughter while you were being held captive. And one of the things you taught her was the Pledge of Allegiance. Was that because you used to start your school days with the pledge?
Yeah, I just remember being in elementary school, and every day that's what we did. So I figured that's what I'll do.
What else were you able to teach her? Like, what kind of materials did you have?
Well, at first, like, I would make my own worksheets with paper. Like, I would just write down 1, 2, 3s and ABCs and her name and shapes. And she would just trace those. And then he would go to yard sales and he would find books there, and I would use that. And then later on, he ended up getting the internet. So he would let me, like, as long as he was sitting there controlling everything, sit there and look through, like, worksheets for, like, her grade. And then I would, like, kind of make my own worksheets based off of that.
How old was she when you were free?
She was 6.
So that's about, like, kindergarten age, right?
Yes.
So did you feel like you'd done a good job, that she was kind of, you know, at the same level as some of the other children her age?
Yes.
Well, good for you.
Thank you.
It's pretty remarkable to be able to say that.
Thank you. That's all I wanted. I wanted her to be normal.
I want to thank the three of you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus have a new memoir about their captivity and escape called Hope, co-written with journalist Mary Jordan. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz tells us about a string ensemble that's blurring the line between classical and more popular kinds of chamber music. This is Fresh Air.
And now we'd like to thank one of our sponsors who helped make today's program possible, Oyster. Oyster would like you to know about their app, where you can subscribe to read as many books as you'd like for a monthly fee. With over 1 million titles in every genre, from Harry Potter to The Goldfinch, Oyster allows you to discover great literature. It's designed to feel personal, with editors' book picks, unique reader themes, and recommendations based on what you like. For a free 30-day trial to Oyster Unlimited, visit oysterbooks.com/NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Some 30 years ago, the Kronos Quartet created a sensation by releasing an album of chamber music that included an arrangement of Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze. Now the string quartet Brooklyn Rider is again blurring the boundaries between classical and more popular kinds of chamber music. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, likes what he's hearing.
Just after New Year's, I heard about a free concert at MIT that I couldn't resist. The Moscow-born violinist Johnny Gandelsman was making his Boston recital debut. He's best known as a member of the string quartet Brooklyn Rider, all of whose players are also part of Yo-Yo Ma's immensely popular world music collective, the Silk Road Ensemble. Gandelsman's program was Bach's complete sonatas and partitas for solo violin. There was little publicity, but the hall was packed. Even Yo-Yo Ma was in the audience. I've heard some famous violinists attempt this epic feat, but none of them gripped me and delighted me as thoroughly as Gandelsman. At the end of this exhausting enterprise, Ma jokingly called out for an encore. Gendelsman happily complied with a couple of bars from one of Bach's suites for solo cello, a Yo-Yo Ma specialty. Everyone laughed. A few months later, I found this same mixture of fun and seriousness when Boston's Celebrity Series invited Brooklyn Rider to make its official Boston debut. This concert was entirely devoted to music from Brooklyn Rider's most recent CD, Almanac, for which the quartet invited a group of contemporary composers, many of them with roots in folk music and jazz, like Vijay Iyer and Bill Frisell, to compose pieces inspired by something outside of their usual field, other kinds of music, art, dance, literature. Iyer's Dig the Say was inspired by James Brown. Among Brooklyn Rider's most attractive qualities are its consistently underlying dance rhythms. It shouldn't be surprising that both violinists, Gendelsman and Colin Jacobson, are married to dancers, Amber Star Merkins and Miley Okamura of the Marc Morris Dance Group. One piece on the Almanac disc is Morris Dance by Ethan Iverson, Marc Morris's former music director. It's a delicious tribute to these two dancers and to Morris's buoyant choreography. In a cello solo, Iverson playfully alludes to an appearance Yo-Yo Ma made with the Morris Company. There's an intimate family feeling here. Colin Jacobson is also a composer, and one of his pieces is on the Almanac CD. His brother Eric is the group's cellist. Violist Nicholas Cords is the brother of jazz saxophonist Daniel Cords, another composer on the album. The players always seem to be having a conversation with each other, and making a conversation between classical and contemporary music. An earlier Brooklyn Rider album called Seven Steps focuses on Beethoven's mysterious late quartet, the seven-movement Opus 131, in the unsettling key of C-sharp minor. For that CD, the group both commissioned a new piece and also wrote the title piece themselves as a group collaboration. Yet it's the Beethoven that seems the edgiest work. Brooklyn Rider's otherworldly tone gives me shivers. Speaking of inspiration, the name Brooklyn Rider derives from the Blue Rider, the legendary group of avant-garde artists in Munich, both Germans and Russian émigrés, which lasted for only 3 years before it was interrupted by World War I. Wassily Kandinsky and Franz Marc were among the founders. And they produced a famous almanac that published music and art, including folk art and works by children, and essays on the spiritual nature of art and music. Brooklyn Rider is clearly a direct descendant.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches in the MFA Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts Boston and writes for the online journal New York Arts. He played music from two recordings by the string quartet Brooklyn Rider. The Norwegian writer Carl Uwe Knausgård has won comparisons to Marcel Proust for his long autobiographical novel My Struggle. This six-volume series is being published in English translation by Archipelago Books. Since 2012, they've been releasing one volume a year. Book four has just come out. Our critic-at-large, John Powers, has read the 1,915 pages of My Struggle published so far, and he says you shouldn't let its length scare you off.
It seems like there's always some writer you're supposed to be reading. These days, it's Carl Uwe Knausgård, the 46-year-old Norwegian whose six-volume, 3,600-page autobiographical novel, My Struggle, has become a literary sensation. Over the last couple of years, I haven't been able to go to a social gathering without someone asking what I thought of his work. When I've said that I hadn't read a word, they would look genuinely startled and tell me, "You have to." Well, I finally gave in a few weeks ago and was abashed to discover that one of Knausgård's trademark themes is his disdain for the sheep-like souls who do exactly what everyone else is doing. Oh well. Still, I'm happy that I succumbed. You see, My Struggle, which is heroically well translated by Don Bartlett, is surely the grand monument to our selfie-absorbed times. In its ambition, narcissism, and exhausting exhaustiveness, the book feels like the culmination of our current obsession with the memoir. Now, one feels a tad silly talking about My Struggle in a short review. I have one word for every 27 pages I've read. But luckily, Knausgård's project isn't arcane. He tells you the story of his life, from his boyhood on a small Norwegian island to his current existence as a writer and married father of four living in Sweden. He gives us his fear and hatred of his domineering father, his feeling of being an unmanly outsider in high school, his love for and battles with his Swedish wife Linda, and much, much, much more. What makes his book extraordinary is not what happens, which couldn't be more familiar or ordinary. It's that Knausgård aims to capture the unending blizzard of feelings, objects, people, and situations that make up a life. At the same time, like Proust, the inevitable point of comparison, he hopes to shape all this stuff into a form that gives his experience a larger meaning. To that end, he plays hopscotch with time, place, and mood. Volume 1 begins with a highfalutin riff on death, moves into a 100-page account of underage Carl and a pal sneaking beer for New Year's Eve, and builds to the burial of his father, in one of the unforgettable sequences in contemporary literature. In contrast, the comparatively lighthearted Volume 4 is filled with boozing and sexual embarrassment. No writer has ever admitted to quite so many premature ejaculations. Knausgård's confident directness has won him raves from scads of star writers, who clearly see new possibilities for their own writing in his books. They especially admire the ways he's not like them. He's earnest, not cute, bouncy, or ironic. He's not afraid to use clichés and doesn't polish every sentence like a new Lamborghini. Unlike most novelists who feel they must compete with video games and Game of Thrones, he doesn't kill himself trying to make every moment exciting. There may be something Oedipal in this. In Volume 3, Knausgård revealingly notes that one of his dad's unbearable qualities was purging any situation of everything that had no direct relevance to what they were doing. If they were going somewhere, Dad drove there grimly fast. If they ate, it was only because food is necessary. Knausgård's own vision of life is almost the opposite. I've never read a good novelist who deliberately included so many things that serve no evident point. For him, such unfiltered inclusiveness does justice to the cluttered density of experience, and it gives his work a strong hypnotic pull. In calling his book My Struggle, Knausgård daringly echoes Hitler's Mein Kampf, which I'm told he talks about at length in Volume 6. But he's not being flip with this title the way an American writer would be. The book actually is about his struggle, with his father, with death, with his muse, with his feelings of inadequacy, with the dreariness of a daily life that offers teasing glimpses of transcendence. If this sounds a bit grandiose, it is. Yet Knausgård is not a difficult writer, like Proust, Joyce, or David Foster Wallace. He's pointedly unliterary. Anyone can understand what he's writing. And paradoxically enough, his honest, obsessive self-absorption makes his life feel universal. As I was reading, every single subject that came up in my daily living, parents, politics, education, Italian food, trees, even David Byrne, reminded me of something in Knausgård. His work makes you realize that each and every one of our lives contains rich enough material for a long, daunting book called My Struggle.
John Powers writes about film and television for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the 4 volumes published in English of My Struggle by Carl Uwe Knausgård. Tomorrow on our show, we'll talk about the California drought and water wars with journalist Mark Arax, who's writing a book on the subject. His family farmed in the San Joaquin Valley, but his father gave up farming and opened a small chain of grocery stores. Then he opened a nightclub where he was murdered in 1972. Arax spent years investigating his father's murder. We'll talk about that, too. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.